congratulations on the mess you made of things. I'm trying to reconstruct the air and all that brings. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Brumberg, who is a professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University. He also serves as senior advisor to the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention, where he focuses on issues of democratization and political reform in the Middle East and the wider Islamic world. His books include Conflict, Identity and Reform in the Muslim World and Reinventing Khomeini, the Struggle for Reform in Iran. His most recent book is U.S. Policy and the Arab World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Brumberg.
Thank you very much.
And clearly we're having a kind of deja vu here and a repeat of history where the this time it's the British Embassy that was sacked by the so-called students calling it a den of spies, and this time shouting death to England. The British have suggested or threatened a vigorous response. What do you think that response will be?
Well, I really don't know. I don't think the Brits are ready to go to war with Iran over this. Will this be a prelude to a complete shutdown of diplomatic relations? Possibly. Even that would surprise me. So we'll have to see what they have in mind. Expulsions of Iranian diplomats on their side, some tit for tat, perhaps. But I don't think it'll go beyond that. On the one level, it looks like the hostage crisis with the United States in 79 or 80 all over again. But, of course, it's really not. They stormed the embassy. As far as I know, they haven't taken hostages. And I'd be very surprised if anything like that happened. But clearly, the Iranian government had provoked this because they're very unhappy with Britain's most recent support for further sanctions on Iran.
Yeah, it followed the parliament voting to downgrade the diplomatic status with England, and the vote was overwhelming, and the MPs apparently chanted death to Britain. So when the British say there are going to be serious consequences, it does seem, though, that the screws are being tightened. And I don't know what's going on in terms of covert activities or a kind of cold war, but I understand that Iran lost India as a major customer for oil because the banking transfers, it's more and more difficult to transfer to actually pay for the oil. Is that their Achilles heel?
I think so. I mean, I think the most recent series of sanctions really address the kind of economic jugular. I mean, the obvious jugular is oil, but the selling of oil and the need for hard currency, you can't operate without an effective banking sector. And the most recent sanctions really put the squeeze on Iran and on the business community. I don't think that's going to elicit an Iranian response along the lines that the West is hoping for, but it certainly increases the internal pressure. We've had also just the other day news of reports of an explosion in a nuclear plant in and around or not far from Isfahan. The Iranians must feel themselves under siege internally and externally as well.
Well, there was the explosion at the missile testing launching site where they lost the Revolutionary Guard Corps general, I think, in charge of their missile program.
That's right. So this is now the second such event that is perceived as, I'm sure, even if they deny it, as internal sabotage.
So it's reasonable then to assume that this isolated and paranoid theocratic regime is even getting more paranoid. Is that?
Well, it has enemies, and it does things that it does things. The most recent IAEA report, depending on who you talk to, offers some pretty damning evidence in terms of Iran's pursuit of weaponization. So, the Iranians find themselves increasingly under diplomatic and economic assault from the West. And while the Russians are and the Chinese have not supported new sanctions through the vehicle of the UN, other sanctions have been imposed by the EU and so on, and this is really taking a toll on Iran's economy, which was not particularly good shape to begin with.
And then, just in terms of their political influence, it looks like they're going to lose Syria, right? In terms of that being
that's a good point. I mean, here you've got not only Turkey, essentially aligned against the Syrian government, against Assad, but if you've got the Arab League, which has imposed its own sanctions, which probably will not hurt that much because Iraq, among others, is not participating in them. But symbolically, the isolation of Syria in the Arab world against the backdrop of the Arab Spring and the drive for democratization really puts Iran in an isolated position regionally when it, just a year ago or less, felt it was riding a wave of popularity and influence in the region.
Well, Dan Brunberg, I spoke to a senior member of the Syrian opposition recently, who's in charge of their foreign affairs department, and he said that he blamed the influence that Iran has over the Iraqi government for their position on voting against the sanctions.
Well, I mean, I think there's no doubt that the Iraqi government's position, part of it is influenced by Iran and the close relationship between the ruling political elite and the Iranian government. I think that's absolutely the case. There are other factors that are involved, including business opportunities and a very vibrant, despite everything, a business community, a Sunni business community in Syria that wants to and has been very eager to pursue trade with Iraq. But I think that's secondary to the political strategic sort of factors that explain why Iraq is not supporting sanctions on Syria.
But Dan Brunberg, I imagine that this Revolutionary Guard Corps kind of government that's run by the supreme leader, and apparently his son has a lot of influence, and he's closely connected to the Guard Corps. Hillary Clinton referred to this government as a kind of military coup at the time after the elections were essentially stolen. Give us a sense of obviously they're paranoid from within as well as being squeezed from without. What happened to the Green Movement, and who were these so-called students because it seems like one hand doing one thing and the other hand, in as much as the foreign ministry condemned the attacks, but it looks as though somebody else, encouraged them.
Well, the foreign ministry has very little autonomous influence over Iranian foreign policy to begin with. And as far as I can tell from the videos of the attack on the British embassy in Tehran, that this was organized by Basij mobilization forces linked to and part of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard. And I do think it reminds us again of the increasing influence of the security apparatus over the politics of the country, the success they've had in shutting out the Green Movement since the presidential elections of June 2009. I think it's premature to conclude that this whole system has been permanently securitized or militarized, and we're dealing with a new kind of Iran, as our Secretary of State put it. This may be the evolution of the system. There's still a lot of fluidity in the Iranian political system and resistance, particularly in the conservative camp, and of course tremendous friction between Ahmadinejad and the supreme leader. So there's a lot of political contentious politics, as we say in academia, and political struggles. But it unfolds against the background of the effort of the supreme leader, backed by the Rev Guards, the Revolutionary Guards, to increasingly centralize power. That is absolutely the case.
Well, Dan Brunberg, I remember talking some time back at the with George Kennan, the famous American diplomat, Mr. X, responsible for the famous memo that shaped the Cold War doctrine. And I spoke with him about the Iranian takeover during the Carter administration. It was some time after that. And I had heard that he had said he had advised the government, the Carter administration, to label what happened as causa belli, and to declare war on Iran at the time, and the Carter administration weren't at all interested. So I asked him about this, and he said, "Yes, indeed, that was his advice." He didn't mean that you would pull the trigger, But he thought that they had crossed the line, the Iranians, in international law, and that you had to acknowledge it. You didn't have to act on it, but you had to acknowledge it. What's your reaction to that?
Well, once you acknowledge it, it puts you in a position of being under pressure to act in ways that you may not be prepared to act. I've been reading reviews of the latest biography about Kennan, and it certainly seems that this kind of advice goes against his focus, certainly with the Soviet Union, on containment and so on. Mm-hmm. But that's an extraordinary story. Certainly, the United States has been in a cold war with Iran for all these years, and occasionally it's turned into a hot war. But it's never. I don't think either side has sought military confrontation until this day, and I don't think that's changed either.
Well, it does, though, lead you to ask, is this a different kind of regime? Because we treat it differently. The world treats it differently, particularly the West, vis-a-vis nuclear weapons. We live with the Pakistanis, we live with the North Koreans, but we can't live with Iran having a nuclear weapon. And particularly on the Israeli side, they suggest that this regime simply cannot be trusted. So when they do things like violate international law and take embassies hostage, or in this case, sack an embassy, doesn't it play into that scenario?
Yes, and I think you put your finger on the main issue, and that is one of trust or the lack thereof and the perceptions of Iranian intentions, which are invariably bad, and Iranians do a lot to earn that distrust. I also think that the question of Israel, Iran's position on the existence of the Jewish state, has very much played into to the perception that an Iran that was armed with nuclear weapons would be of a greater danger than one without them. So it definitely plays into this. I also think we have to recognize that we have a Cold War history with Iran. It goes back to 1979, the humiliation of the United States and the hostage incident. There's a great deal of, if you like, psychological resistance to
right. Well, there's
anything else but a problem.
Well, you could go back. Surely you go back to Mossadegh, don't you? Isn't that still a great wound in the polity of Iran?
Yes, and the Iranians are, and that of course helps to explain why. I mean, the Iranians have a particular issue with Britain, and this dates back to the Mossadegh era and his efforts to nationalize the Iranian oil industry and so on, the hostility towards Britain. But in fact, it predates that, and theories of British influence and the conspiracy theory are rife in Iran. And in many respects, Britain is an envisioned enemy is more important to that kind of paranoid psyche than the United States and we see this played into the whole storming of the British embassy here too. But Iranians have a reason, and it's not based merely on perception or irrational fears. A reason to be concerned about internal influence and meddling. Having said that, the great paradox is they keep doing things which sort of invite that very meddling. There's this kind of love-hate relationship, this disdain for the West, this constant denunciation of meddling, yet a behavior that seems to almost invite that kind of meddling and that kind of treatment of Iran, almost a symbiotic relationship between those two sort of dynamics.
Well, the Ayatollah Khomeini was locked in many ways in a different century as a cleric. He for example, he referred to when he was obviously opposed to Jimmy Carter, but he seemed to I know that in one of his speeches he referred to as the German Carter, the American Carter, thinking that the word Carter meant foreign leader. A lot of people said that he really didn't have any kind of worldly outlook. And given this, this is such a theocratic regime. Do the current the supreme leader, who has absolute power, does he have any kind of sophistication about the world?
Perhaps in some respects, a notch above. He's proven adept both internally, that's for sure, and externally in many ways, given his own interests. But having said that, I think he has a very limited worldview as well. Very limited exposure to anything outside of the direct circle of the kinds of people he's been surrounded by all his life. And I think that definitely affects Iran's foreign policy. And also, I think you have to recognize that there's been a change of elites in Iran over the past few years, a rise of a kind of an elite whose roots are in the provincial areas, who don't have any, very little exposure to the West and experience overseas. And this plays into it as well. And you have to remember that the Islamic Revolution was made by revolutionaries, many of whom had spent extensive time in England, France, and of all places, Texas. who had a sense of the world.
Sure.
This rising elite that is linked to the Revolutionary Guard right. doesn't have.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Dan Brunberg.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Brunberg, who's professor of the Department of Government at Georgetown University. He also serves as senior advisor to the Center of Conflict Analysis and Prevention. And his books include Conflict, Identity and Reform in the Muslim World and Reinventing Khomeini, the Struggle for Reform in Iran. His latest book is U.S. Policy and the Arab World. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we begin with Russell McIver, the editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter. He also wrote On the Rampage, Corporate Predators and the Destruction of Democracy. He's been visiting a lot of the Occupy sites, particularly in the D.C. area, where there are two competing sites, one that is allegedly being taken over by the Democratic Party operatives, although that wasn't entirely clear of who they were and how successful they were being. But we talked largely about, will the message, particularly the powerful message of the 99% versus the 1%, outlast the movement and translate in electoral politics. And he felt that there had to be some political translation. He obviously does not support the Democratic Party and would like an alternative, but recognizes the nature of America's two-party system, making it very difficult for a third party to emerge, and just quite how the politics and the political energy of the Occupy movement will be translated. He wasn't sure, but he felt that at least starting at the precinct level, at the grassroots level, the activists should start working the politics of this country without, you know, obviously being specific. But clearly, if the grassroots movements at least began, he felt that that would have a huge impact. Then we talked with Adele Stan, who's a Washington Bureau Chief for Alternet. Always find her amusing. She's been covering the Tea Party from the beginning and their favorite son, Herman Cain, who just had the latest bimbo eruption with the fifth woman coming forth. She felt that he was toast, largely because, unlike Newt Gingrich, who confessed to adultery, which is in a sin, it's in one of the 10th commandments, Cain keeps, you know, denying, and that's not going to play with the religious right. You've got to call for redemption, which he's not doing, and they control the primaries in South Carolina and particularly the first one in Iowa. So he probably will pull out. But still, let's face it, at least he's been entertaining compared to the rest of them. And then I talked with Dan Brunberg, a specialist on Iran, about the so-called Iranian students taking over the British embassy, which they called a den of spies, and chanting death to England. Of course, that has echoes of what happened back in Carter's day with the 444 days of hostage taking. He felt that they weren't students, that they were the besieged militia, a part of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and that indeed this is a paranoid regime. But he said they have reason to be paranoid. A lot of people are out to get them, and the West is tightening the screws, and they're losing their influence in Syria, and they don't play by the normal rules, and they strike out in these kind of ways. We can expect more of it. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was